in this that we're, any part of it is taking away from the issue about safety. With that, we heard about great resources, there's tremendous leadership within the state, but the reality is also that there's gaps in services. We're also hearing that there is commitment, but we need even a greater commitment on all levels, whether it's within the leadership or within the programs, and especially within the policies. So, and that we don't need to reinvent the wheel with other states or agencies that have developed evidence-based programs. There's also an investment that needs to be made, not just in money, but also an investment within the policies, both from people coming in from the front end and people coming out of the criminal justice system. That this issue cannot be just looked at as a punitive methodology, but looking at it as a healing environment where it keeps accountability, it also keeps people working together, both within the agencies and also with the offenders. And that change can happen, that over this time that stars are starting to align, both locally and on a statewide basis, that we're seeing a consensus that there needs to be that systematic change. There's been a focus on looking at not just the static factors, but looking at the criminogenic behaviors that need to be changed, and those are being implemented on a number of communities that are going on. What also was being presented was saying we don't need to repeat history. We don't need to close the detox centers. We don't need to figure out and repeat that same process during economic crisis times. And that, again, that it comes back to knocking down those barriers of not just what's happening within our own agencies, but what's happening throughout the entire criminal justice system and throughout our entire community. So we've learned about the past, we've learned about the present, and we also need to look at what's happening today with from our state legislators. And so without further ado, Senator Robert Creedon and Representative Eugene O'Flattery to hear your advice and insights about this process. Thank you.
Let me lead off, please. Thank you, and good morning. Welcome to the State House. My experience in this area is not academic. I was an English major, life experience, I guess. My daughter-in-law-to-be is finishing her doctorate in psychology, and I told her, I said, Maura, you're reading about people that I grew up with. She was at the Lemley Shattuck, they asked a little practice, and I was explaining to her, I said, well, some of the kids that I grew up went to places like Oakdale, Lyman, and Shirley. Those were called training schools or reform schools. And then some of them graduated to the Plymouth County House of Correction, and then the real stars went to Walpole, now Cedar Junction. And we've got some bad folks up at Sousa Baranowski and lesser troublesome fellows at Concord and other institutions. We also didn't have many women defendants in those days. And the upside, the good side, was practicing law. Some of my pals became clients. And I look at this problem, therefore, from a practical standpoint. Mom and Dad raised five boys that they had in an eight-year period in the east side of Brockton. And so we lived amongst folks who were problematic. But to give you the magnitude, we only had in the city of Brockton, there's 100,000 folks there, one district court judge. We now have, and a part-time judge, we now have six. In the Superior Court, when I started practicing law, July and August were vacation months. Court wasn't active. Now it's round the clock and we need more criminal sessions. So there's been an expansion of dysfunctional families and dysfunctional folks. I could take you to any district court today, better on a Monday because after the weekend the arrests are up, and you would see that most of the defendants are male and under 30. They usually get sick and tired of being sick and tired and clean up their act and don't graduate. The real bad ones do. I used to remember, what was his name? Father Flanagan. There's no such thing as a bad boy. I wish I was that optimistic. There are bad boys and bad men. But they're generally the small minority. And as this panel indicated to you, most of these kids and young adults have problems with substance abuse, whether it's alcohol or drugs. If you can somehow solve that problem, they don't enter the system at all. But when they do, the problem is, what do we do with them when they get out? One area is supervision, whether it's parole or probation. We need more attention to that, and I mean hands-on. I mean, I knew the probation officers in Brockton. We all knew them because they're out working the community. Now, because of a demand for more statistics, the paperwork buries these poor people. So we need more hands-on supervision once you're released, whether it's the House of Correction or the state prison system. And the other thing which is key is jobs. We had Brockton clean up two Saturdays ago, and I had a young lad with me who was 18. He's never had a summer job. And he's in what we call community service. Instead of sending them away, I put them in DYS, they go out and do community service, painting hydrants, painting courthouses, tasks of that sort. What we need, and thank goodness here, we've got a governor and a secretary who are hands-on people. I've been in this building since 97, and this is the first governor who I would call hands-on. He cares, and he wants to get involved in it. So it's a perfect opportunity to start solving these problems. But again, it costs money. Gene and I have to battle constantly with the get tough on crime stuff. It doesn't work, and there's an attempt to take discretion away from judges. That doesn't work either. I've practiced law since 67, a good deal of it criminal. You have a probation officer and a judge who know more about that case than the local media or those people calling for get tough on crime. I can tell you, doesn't work. We lost the Lakeville Hospital to a clean elections case. That would have been an ideal place to put folks who aren't violent. Those folks who, because of substance abuse, have to do some time, they're going to do the time. They're not going to leave. You could put them up in the Holiday Inn. It's costing us $44,000 a year to incarcerate these folks. You could put them in a pup tent. They're not going to leave. They'll do their 6 months. But now we put them in a house of correction with folks that they shouldn't be with. So I notice we're behind in our schedule here.
No, but you're doing great.
Question and answer period, we can get to other subjects that I would like to talk about. And I think my co-chair and I, he from Chelsea, I from Brockton, support many of these programs, but we also believe we're part of a commonwealth, and some of our suburban communities ought to share in not just the wealth, but some of the burdens when we're talking about these programs. So, having said that, Gene?
And that's a great lead-in for me, Senator. I wanted to, first of all, good morning to everybody, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this panel. It's an honor for me to be here today. I just want to follow up on what Senator Creedon said and certainly what Michael said about no discussion so far about community support. And I just want to give somewhat of a little political perspective about what Senator Creedon and I have to deal with when we talk about these issues, me in the House and obviously Senator Creedon in the Senate. And maybe I can throw these ideas out there so that we can have some discourse, if not today, perhaps in the very near future. In Chelsea, where I live, I represent the 2nd Suffolk District, which is most of the city of Chelsea for me and the entire Boston neighborhood of Charlestown. Like Senator Creed and I have been in this building since 1997 as well. And in Chelsea, we have methadone clinics. In Charlestown, we have recovery homes for alcoholics and substance abuse. We have affordable housing, and we have housing developments, unlike a lot of our suburban and rural colleagues. We are the ones whose these types of programs immediately benefit because, quite frankly, there are constituents who are in your custody for a temporary period of time, who are brought into the system by Commissioner Davis and the fine men and women that he has working with him in the Boston Police Department. And on my other hat, for a period of time, I was the person that was defending them in court as a public defender, and of course still continue to do so in my private law practice. So like Senator Creedon, I also have a very practical perspective on this issue, being a criminal defense lawyer now for 14 years. And when I talk to my colleagues about these issues, which for from a policy perspective are designed to be helpful to my constituents, I am met with very private anxiety about expansion of these types of programs because these folks are concerned about my constituents actually leaving my district and moving into theirs. So it's very, very easy to have an idealistic conversation to some degree about the merits or the concepts, but politically the reality is that we encounter, and I think I'm speaking for Senator Creedon as well, great difficulty when discussing these issues with our colleagues. On page 12 of this report, off to the right-hand side, is a few statistics. It says public housing authorities may be required to deny housing to drug offenders. I represent the largest public housing development in the city of Boston, the Bunker Hill Housing Development. I meet with men, women, families concerned about their children, concerned about drug dealers, coming back into the housing development, even though under the city of Boston's rules they're not supposed to, but somehow they end up there. I talk with parents and attend community meetings who are concerned about their kids walking to and from school, to and from the Boys and Girls Club because they're enticed to join gangs, to sell drugs, to do things to make them part of the neighborhood clique. I oftentimes wonder if you lived in public housing where you don't have a choice where you live, almost like educational systems, why I support charter schools, because if you have money, you can move. But if you don't have money, you have to live in that public housing development. So I ask, and this is not necessarily directed at anybody, but would you like to live in a housing development with known gang members and with people that are drug offenders coming back into your public housing development? I have a few questions as well about the statistic here that says employers rarely consider hiring an ex-offender. Most of the businesses in Massachusetts are small businesses. They're owned by 3 to 5 people. They operate on a shoestring budget. They are our small businesses. If you had a choice of hiring somebody as a small business person concerned about making money for yourself and your family and paying your mortgage, would you hire an ex-offender or would you hire a person that has a clean record? Just a hypothetical question. And also, I'll end with this. In my neighborhood that I grew up in, and the neighborhood I represent across the bridge in Charlestown, like Senator Creedon, I've had a lot of friends that prior to being elected, I've had to visit in your facilities. They're men that I grew up with that I'm proud today to call my friends, but they made wrong decisions because of substance abuse and alcoholism mostly. But they're not looking for sympathy. They're looking to get on with their lives, and I understand that, and I want to be helpful to them. I was actually posed this question by an elderly lady in my district. Some of them are so wise and have seen so much in their lives. And she asked me, "Gene, I've been hearing about this Say No to Drugs program for years and years and years, and I hear all the messages that are taught in school about staying out of trouble and making right decisions and walk away and do the right thing. Well, most of the kids that I grew up with, and most of the kids that I know in those neighborhoods I represent, and I'm going to be presumptuous and assume the other districts as well, do make the right decisions. They come from homes where it's difficult economically, they struggle to make ends meet, but somehow they do it. And they do the right thing at the right time. They make those decisions to walk away on that Friday night when trouble's brewing. They know not to hang around with the particular kids who are getting into more serious trouble. But then, at some point, the two of those individuals, the one that listened to the message and stayed out of trouble and made all the right decisions, is going to be going to an employer. And the young person who made the wrong decisions, who has been in and out of the system, is also going to go to that employer. And I just ask a very simple hypothetical question. Does that kid who made the right decisions deserve less than the kid that made the wrong decisions? Do those messages mean anything? Did all those years of trying to educate that kid to do the right thing, does that mean something at the end? Or are we simply going to say we're going to treat them both equally for that same job? Just a hypothetical. Thank you.
Thank you. And you both brought up excellent, relevant, realistic questions and concerns that need to be brought to the table to have that discussion, to bring those questions out and to listen to both sides of the table to make sure that we're keeping our community safe and also making sure that there's success for everybody, whether it's the people that stay out of crime or the people that are coming back into our community so that they don't go back into the criminal justice system. So, and that's part of this discussion that we want to hear from you, of your thoughts and concerns also. So let's keep the conversation going.